Hey, friend. I know how it feels, waking up exhausted after multiple trips to the bathroom and feeling embarrassed by sudden leaks. I used to be constantly on edge, searching for a restroom whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Woman. I was skeptical at first, but 2 months in, everything changed. I experienced improved bladder control. No more heart-stopping moments when I laugh or sneeze, less urge to go, deeper and more restful sleep. I finally felt like myself again, confident and in control. Better Woman is natural, effective, and trusted by women for over 25 years. Ready to take back your control? Head over to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Uses directed, individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker. Today's episode is sponsored by Sporting Index. My name is Thomas Rooney, and once again, I'm delighted to be joined by the chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. How's it going, Mo?
It's fantastic. World Cup is still going on. It's still brilliant, and I'm having a great time.
Excellent. And we've also got the assistant editor at Squawker, Jake Entwistle. How's it going, Jake?
Yeah, it's just going so great at the moment, isn't it? So glad to be back on here.
Excellent. And then from Sporting Index, we've got Ed Fulton again. Good to have you with us again, Ed.
No, good to be back. Thanks so much.
With obviously the decisive group games and the knockout stages, there's going to be some good fun on the spread betting stakes, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, we'll come on to the England game, but we were cruising along rather nicely in this World Cup, and it came to a shuddering halt yesterday, as you can imagine, in England win.
There
was some issue in the office because some of the younger lads were getting excited for England winning, and some of the senior traders were not particularly pleased.
Bit of a split in the office.
Well, it's a tough one. I mean, you have to respect your employees' positions, but it's great, I think, and just for the World Cup, it's good that at the moment, at least, England are cruising along nicely, and because you want them still in there.
Absolutely, really. And they're through to the round of 16 after the thumping win over Panama, Jake. First of all, I was wondering, how much do you think we can read into it? Because the cynics going, it's only Panama, but at the same time, England won a World Cup game 6-1 and were fantastic for most of it. So how much can be read into the result, do you think?
I think that's exactly it. It is 6-1 and it is against Panama, but how often do we do that at a World Cup anyway? Even in friendlies, we've played much weaker teams, and the recent one that comes to mind, wasn't it a 1-0 last minute winner against Lithuania from Harry Kane? That's like, that as a recent game, that was at Wembley as well. So in terms of, yes, you can read in that we might not win the tournament because we've beaten Panama 6-1, but you can flip that and say beating Panama 6-1 is huge for England because we created chances, we looked fluid in attack. For the first time in a while, we actually haven't started that well in the game, which was odd, and I loved Gareth Southgate after the game saying I actually wasn't happy with that game, because he said the start wasn't very good, the conceding the goal wasn't very good, there was a really good middle part where we obviously just blitzed them, and that's becoming a theme of this England side as well. So yes, it's obviously too soon to be getting excited about winning a World Cup, although I am very much on that hype train. I think we're doing so well and I think we have the opportunity to go far, but in terms of dismissing the result completely, I think that's really wrong because, as I said, we've struggled in those games before. Panama played aggressively, they were wrestling us in the box pretty much, and sometimes we've sort of flaked away from that, but we stuck to our principles. The game plan from Gareth Southgate is so clear, and the formation is working wonderfully with players really shining that you didn't think would be the main protagonists of this England side, but they're coming to the fore. And obviously, Harry Kane scoring a hat-trick, and he wasn't anywhere near the best player on the pitch. Mm. So everything's going really well. And I think to dismiss the result, as I said, would be just completely bizarre.
You can read everything into it.
Mo's getting excited, aren't you, mate?
Oh, very excited. Look, like Jay says, it's Panama, but you don't slap teams 6-1 in the World Cup for nothing. Look, Germany slapped Saudi Arabia 8-0 in 2002, right? And everyone was like, well, it's just Saudi Arabia. Germany ended up in the final. Right now, they had a bit of luck getting there. They played South Korea the semi-finals, very, very weak semi-finalists. But it's you don't slap a team 6-1 for nothing. You know, Belgium didn't beat them 6-1. You know, and Belgium are a very high-powered team. It's very impressive. And the fact is, what was, I think, the most impressive thing about anything else was that, like Jesse, England didn't really play too well. The especially at the start, especially in the end, the possession wasn't as fluid as it was against Tunisia. It wasn't as good. I mean, mostly because Panama just kept kicking the life out of England players. But England found a way to win. Harry Kane did not play well at all. Scored 3 goals. England found a way to win. They didn't create really too much of an open play, apart from obviously the amazing Jesse Lingard goal. But they scored 2 from set pieces. England found a way to win. It's becoming a theme, because even against Tunisia, it was like all this beautiful football, couldn't, hammering at the door, couldn't get in. 2 set pieces, 2 goals. England have found a way to win. There's a sort of like, it's like life in Jurassic Park. It finds a way. You know, England have this sort of knack. They've developed this sort of knack of just like getting through. And I mean, it's obviously very early, and obviously we've played 2 bad teams, so you don't want to get too carried away. But there's signs there that England have what it takes to tussle against the better team. Because, okay, fine, let's say you play a Spain or even a Belgium and you get dominated in the game, but then you're this free-flowing side, but you can also score on set pieces. So even if you're getting dominated, nick a set piece, you could get a goal, and that gives you this extra level of threat. So look, it's 2 games into the group. We haven't even got out of the group yet. Let's see what happens. But I think England have been one of the more impressive sides of the tournament, put it that way.
Absolutely. And Ed, do you feel like, I mean, it's England's biggest ever World Cup win, but also it's Panama's second ever World Cup game. So did you enjoy the match? I mean, are you sort of going along the hype train of getting a bit carried away?
Yeah, I think you have to be positive. It would be sort of churlish, really, to try and, you know, pick holes in that. One of the great positives yesterday was the fact they're willing to look at the set piece in the box, and the ref was keeping a very close eye on it, and penalty came directly from that, because mm-hmm. that's England's strength. You get the big tall lads in there, and that could easily play out again in the latter stages of England get there. Tunisia got away with it. Clearly FIFA had noticed that, and the ref was really on it, and Panama was stupid enough to keep doing it.
It was crazy, wasn't it?
And they paid the price. So other teams will have to be very careful about how much you rugby tackle Kane and Stones and all these things. But I think it's as I said, it's good for England to still be in there. And I don't think you can create a solid argument that you can dismiss it. You know, the interesting thing yesterday was Panama went from wonderful overachievers and sweet boys, and they're all getting up at 7 o'clock at home, so sort of pariahs within 25 minutes. I think they said on the radio, they're not a very lovable side, are they? And yeah, they did behave. The toys did come out of the pram a bit.
It's very naive as well, I thought, the way they were sort of wrestling the players.
Yeah, and then they didn't seem to be listening to the coach and stuff. So they sort of fell apart quite quickly. I think you have to give England a lot of credit for that, because, you know, you concede that many that early. You are going to struggle to keep your composure.
Absolutely. And just, you mentioned briefly earlier, but in terms of the sporting index and the traders' reaction to the England results, sort of how did that pan out before and during the game?
Yeah, well, I had a long chat with the guy who traded the game last night, and he was... The one good thing was the goals came early, because generally in spread betting, people have bought times of player goal minutes and stuff. So obviously if you score in the 90th minute and you've bought Harry Kane goal minutes at, say, 30... and he scores in the 90th, there's a difference there of 60. So you're going to win 60 times your stake. But because all the goals tended to come early, that limited the damage that we did.
Yeah.
So I think what we did, it was easily our worst game. I won't say a number, but it was, you know, it took a lot of profit away from the tournament. But if, thank goodness, they stopped playing in the second half.
Yeah,
it kind of became a bit pitter-patter. You know, Panama were happy to not concede anymore. And England said, well, we'll pass it round, come and get the ball off us. And they didn't.
Well, I suppose it was 1-1 second half, wasn't it?
Well, how do you, it's very tricky when you win a first half 5-0 to really keep going. I feel like had he brought on Rashford at half time for Kane, instead of bringing on Vardy for Kane when Kane got his hat-trick, I understand why he left Kane on, obviously, I'm not saying he should have done, but I'm just saying, if he brought on maybe Rashford and maybe Trent Alexander-Arnold or something, basically someone that was really hungry to get a goal, it might have kicked the team on to sort of carry on, and maybe they would have racked up 3 or 4 more goals. But he brought on Vardy, who runs around a lot, but I don't think he didn't seem to be too interested. He wanted to try and score, but no one else wanted to really help him. They didn't bring on anyone in like the lower bands of the pitch, midfield, defence, to try and push the team forward. They were all just like, let's just keep the ball, let's just keep the ball. He brought Danny Rose on, but that was like, I think the game was... It was pretty much over at that point. So, but I mean, it was I think had he brought on Rashford, which I really was annoyed that he didn't actually. I think there would have been.
You got Rashford on instead of Vardy, right?
Oh, all day. I would have brought on at half time, but then I mean, I'm glad because Kane got a hat trick in the end. But I mean, I would have brought Rashford on at half time, 5-0 up. What are you doing? Take him off. Get Rashford and Sterling up front. Let them run, man. Let them because that would have renewed. Rashford would have renewed Sterling. They would have really had a sort of let's try and do it. Lingard would have been really enthused. Like, okay, let me get my mate a goal. You know, they're really good friends, roommates. So. I mean, that would have reinvigorated the whole thing. He went with Vardy. I understand why he went with Vardy. I understand his point. He wants to get everyone involved. I just would have gone with Rashford. It would have really kicked the whole side on.
And Jake, sorry, on that on sort of similar note, who was your man of the match in the game? Because obviously you mentioned Kane was not the best player on the pitch, but got a hat-trick. Who was your standout player for England?
I think Mo touched on it there, the fact that Jesse Lingard would have been supercharged if Rashford came on, because he was already playing so well that if the chance to like tee up his roommate for a goal would have completed his performance. But I think, like talking about it and watching that England game sort of again, I think Jesse Lingard does stand out. Mm. What was funny about this game from like Skorka's perspective is that obviously we're very much focused on the numbers and no one in the England team posted an incredible game in terms of massive output statistically. And that again speaks to the style of play. And this 3-5-2 is very much built off what people do off the ball rather than on it. The most touches will always be the three centre-backs in this team because that's where everything starts. And then plus Henderson distributing the ball. But Jesse Lingard and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who played instead of Ali and that game, their movement and their sort of exchanges with each player are so key. And we saw it for Jesse Lingard's goal. It actually did break down. Sterling was tackled, but he got the ball. But that move started from the back, was moved over, came and Lingard just arrived on the edge of the box and curled it top corner. So that was a great moment for him because it really cemented, wait, Lingard's been really impressive these two games. And I'll admit as well that, like I think everyone has said during the coverage of this tournament, I think even Brian Robson mentioned some quotes the other day saying that he'd never seen anything that suggested Lingard would be more than a squad player. Mm. Very small, very slight. And yes, maybe that's sort of an older point of view that you need to be big to be good. And I don't agree with that anyway. But even with Lingard watching him, you think, yeah, he's good for 20 minutes, but is he good for the whole game? And he's been good for every minute he's been on the pitch so far. Yeah. So he was my man of the match.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think I wrote a piece about this yesterday. What makes Jesse Lingard has sort of unlocked the key to Jesse Lingard is putting him in central midfield. Because I think the thing is, right, obviously, first he was mistaken for a winger because he's small and quick, but he's not a winger. Then Mourinho, of all people, realised, okay, this guy's a 10. So he pulled him infield, and he plays much better there in the central areas, off, you know, playing off the striker. He makes great runs. The problem with that is, of course, if you're playing a team that has any sort of deep line defence, he can't do anything because he can't run beyond a striker when there's no space beyond the striker. So he gets sort of stagnated, and he's not like a super creative kind of guy. Like, he's not Iniesta. But he has movement like Iniesta in the way he sort of drifts into spaces and links with players. So what do? Put him in central midfield. Now suddenly he's got half a pitch to move into when he gets the ball. It allows him to build up a head of steam. He's facing the goal at all times. He's never having to have his back to goal because he can't play like that. He's not big enough to do it. Now suddenly you see, and he saw it on the goal. You see, you've got him moving ahead, and you've got two players ahead of him. Sterling can drop and link with him. Kane can move ahead and go beyond. And you saw it in the goal. He passes it to Sterling. Sterling passes it back to him. Kane runs forward, pulls the defence away. Defence can't step up to meet him. He gets the ball, looks at goal, whack. Top corner, you know, and that's the brilliance of putting him. And Dele Alli is the same kind of thing. Dele Alli, obviously, though, is more of a established midfielder, but essentially they're the same thing. They're two attacking midfielders that Southgate's put in central midfield, giving them more space to move into, and it makes the entire formation, like Jake says, it's about off the ball movement almost. Really, there's no playmaker in England's team. It's like it's a group of three guys mainly. It's those three. It's Dele or Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Jesse Lingard and Sterling, and that's why he plays them, why he keeps playing Sterling, because Sterling's movement is essential part of this. Those three are sort of like they're all the playmakers, if you will, and they combine with each other, and their movement creates havoc to mark with. Who do you mark them when they're doing that? And then Harry Kane's just like drifting around looking for a space, looking for a goal, and it's you've got fixed width with the wingers, and it's I'm really glad Southgate never deviated from this formation, because I think it's so good for what England have, for England's best players, the young, creative, attacking players. And yeah, Lingard was man of the match easily. And I think he's unlocked something there by putting him deeper. I don't think you could translate it to Man United, because I don't think Mourinho will ever play this kind of football at Man United. But you could see how... And, you know, and I hate to give Mourinho credit for anything, but there was a bit last season where Mourinho said that Lingard was a midfielder, and we were all like, what are you talking about? No, he's not. But you can see now if Mourinho were to play Lingard in central midfield in a 4-3-3, you could see how maybe it would work, because it sort of unlocks what's so great about him. Of course, then you have to have everyone else playing the same kind of way, which is where United would fall down, because they don't play that way. But for England, I think Lingard in midfield is I mean, he should keep that number 7 shirt after the tournament, man. That should be his shirt now from now on.
I think Oxlade-Chamberlain's injury is maybe
Yeah,
and it's horrible to say, like, it's helped Jesse Lingard, because before the tournament, it was very much a 3-4-3 rather than a 3-1-4-2. Whether Southgate would have moved towards that anyway, and I think he was, to be fair to him, moving towards that, I think it would have been very much Oxlade-Chamberlain, who fits that role perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely.
He would have been the one, he can carry the ball. He's one of the best carriers of the ball in that England team, and I think he would have had his place in that starting 11. So then the Dele-Jesse sort of debate would have been even more rife, because they would have been fighting for that one spot. Whereas being able to play them both now, it's like, wow, hold on, we've got these two incredibly intelligent footballers, which is very rare for the type of midfielders England produce, and we get to play them both in the same team, and they get, and as Mo said, they both get half a pitch to work with. We're not playing them number 10, we're playing them in central midfield. Henderson is covering both of them, and they get to just drift around, linking up with, they've got four, they've got a wing back to link to, they've got a holding midfielder to bounce it off, they've got a target man to link to, and then they've got another little agile, intelligent forward in Raheem Sterling to link to. So everywhere those two turn, there's a passing option. And I think we look so good on the ball, it's ridiculous. And then we're like Atletico Madrid from set pieces. Southgate deserves massive credit for being able to implement a style of play that is attractive to watch. But when it comes down to it, the basics, we're doing so well. And I think one quick point on that is, I've seen a lot of those quotes about him watching NBA and implementing styles for that, and talking about how certain runs for players will block off people legally to create space for others. And I think that's why England and the wrestling in the box has been heightened when watching England the most, because Southgate has clearly developed a sort of three-point running corner system where each runner has their particular route to do when the ball is delivered, and it blocks other people off. And the only way to defend that is literally grab hold of them and stop them completing that route. So I think, again, I've said it every time I'm on here, he deserves massive credit for implementing that. But also the players have absolutely flourished in that system. And it's great to see.
I could say, moving on, so obviously Belgium next, Ed. Are you seeing much money the trading on that game, and is there anything on, like, who's going to top the group and things like that?
The guy was very wary about going down with prices for that game because of noises coming out of the Belgian camp in terms of what Martinez was going to do.
And absolutely,
what England would do. When I left, we had England. We're doing group betting for Group G, which is 25 points for the winner, 10 for coming second. And at the moment, we've got Belgium 17.25, 18.25, and England just a bit lower, 16.75. 17.75. So if you fancy England to win the group, you'd be a buyer at 17.75. They'd make up 25. The downsides, because obviously you can lose, 7.75. So we've nudged Belgium into favouritism. A draw would be enough for England to win the group, as long as they didn't get more bookings.
Yeah, because at the moment they're top on Fair Play at the moment, I think, because of one fewer booking. So yeah.
Yeah, but I don't. It's not a game I'd look at and expect bookings. I mean, there's been so few in this. Well, I mean, Poland, Colombia last night, there were at least five challenges in the first half that would be automatic yellows in most European leagues, and there were zero. Mexican ref said, no, and England, Belgium, fairly clean sides, I think.
England have been fairly disciplined as well.
You say that, but Fellaini.
I don't think he's going to start.
It depends on the Belgium team. They could unleash Fellaini and Witzel in that centre midfield pivot, and it would just be hacking down those two England midfielders.
So much of the media, the print media and the radio media, is talking about, where do you want to come? Do you want to come first? Do you want to come second? I just don't think you can even, as part of the England management group, you can't even start having that, the thought process. You just go out, you play your best. Players aren't going to take it easy because they think, you know, we might get Japan. You could get Japan, you could get Senegal, or you could get Colombia, and you don't know what order that's going to be. You can then start looking at the quarterfinal and the structure of that and say, well, we want to avoid Brazil. But do you really want to avoid Brazil to get Mexico or whatever that?
Yeah, I just, it's a tough one.
You know, take on the big boys. It's a World Cup that doesn't have an outstanding side. Stop trying to... We always do it. It's an England thing. Well, well, what's the route to the final? The route to the final is seven games. You've done two of them. You look pretty good. Be good in the third and be good in the fourth and then see what happens. And I think Southgate's too clever. I think that whole thing with the team sheet thing,
yeah,
that was just a stitch-up. They knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it wasn't the team that was on the list that played.
No, it suggested Rashford was going to start, didn't it?
And obviously, if you are playing that game, you then have to come out and apologise to the players for being disrespectful. You could see the way he was holding it.
Jorge Sampaoli is walking around the Argentine training camp with the exact same thing. His team's getting linked. He's doing it on purpose. You don't do that on accident.
No.
You know that there are people taking pictures. You know, you don't wave your hand around, and you know it creates a bit of anger because he got a bit angry at the media, and then he was like, then he apologised. I think he was trying to sort of maybe get them into cheerleading mode or something. But yeah, like you don't do that on accident.
It's just a bit of fun, and you know the media have access to the players far more than they have in other tournaments.
Yeah.
You know, they sit and they play PlayStation together and stuff, and they do Instagram, all the stuff that kids do these days. So lost on me, but there is interaction there. That the millennial group sort of they grow up with that. They expect to share their lives and their playing lives with people. So I think kind of the media, it's a hard. There's no angle really to criticise this England side until they get beat. Really,
yeah. Then we'll go to town.
But hopefully they'll be in the knockout. So we'll be too late to. So I think there's a buzz around the camp. Everyone's in happy campers, you know, and that's great.
And just on the Belgium game, Jake. Do you think obviously it's Martinez's. Certainly suggested he's going to rest players. Do you think Southgate should do the same, or should we keep the momentum going? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm sort of in the. I have sort of planned out who we'll get. I said from the beginning. I think actually second in this group is better, purely not because of avoiding certain teams. I just thought matching up even against the bigger ones, we have more chance against the biggest teams in that side.
Yeah, we were saying draw Germany, weren't we? Before like in the quarterfinals, we could beat them.
So. I completely agree with that point. Like the route to the final is seven games. I thought that was brilliantly put, but I have been guilty of working out that thing. And against Belgium, Martinez said that he said that there were three injuries from that Tunisia game, and it was Lukaku, Mertens, and Hazard.
Funny that, wasn't it?
So his front three, which are arguably the most potent area of that team, if they're rested, it was funny though because even if they get rested, Batshuayi actually came on. Kevin De Bruyne moved into the front three. And Batshuayi had six shots in 22 minutes, which was the most in the game. So Belgium, like their style of play, if De Bruyne moves forward because they're resting those front three, they'll still be dangerous. I just think it would be clever to rest players because the World Cup is obviously intense. Obviously, the heat in that last England game was exhausting as well. So there are conditions where I think resting players is going to be key. And the fact that both teams are through... As we've said, coming second would be fine. Finishing top would be fine. So it almost seems like a win-win situation unless we get pumped 5-0 by Belgium and everyone goes to town on that. But I think this is a perfect time to test out the sort of tactic that I think we will use against the stronger sides. And I think Rashford didn't come on against Panama because he's going to start. And yep. I think he'll start with Vardy as we did against Costa Rica. And it will be a much more counter-attacking focused side because Belgium, their wing-backs, one is Thomas Meunier, who is billed as a right-back, but he's the most attacking wing-back I've seen. And Yannick Carrasco is the left wing-back, who is a winger. So they pose as much threat as they cause trouble for Belgium. And I think we should rest players. And also, it's not resting players because we need to rest them. It's the chance to sort of test out this formation. As we said, we've played two weaker teams and we've absolutely dominated them. I think we looked better against Tunisia than Panama, but we scored six against Panama. But now we're going to play a team that's just as good or better in terms of man-to-man quality. So now we should try out this counter-attacking system that we sort of dabbled with against Brazil and Germany, but got absolutely... We were all over the place there. I know it was 0-0, but they were completely dominant. I think now we play Rashford and Vardy up front. You have more distribution in centre midfield in terms of actual passing rather than this off-the-ball movement, and you look to counter-attack them. So we rest players because we need to, and we rest players because we're also going to try something new.
Mo, would you agree with that?
I would definitely say rest players. England have a stronger squad than Belgium. I mean, admittedly, he'll up front, obviously Belgium have strong strength. He'll drop out that front three. He'll push De Bruyne forward, put Fellaini in midfield. He'll have... probably De Bruyne, Tielemans, and and Batshuayi up front. That's still pretty strong, but that's, you know, without Hazard and without Lukaku in particular, I think that's going to be a bit tricky. I mean, Tunisia were flagging at the end. That's why Batshuayi had so many chances. I don't think, against a fresh defence, I don't think it had that much. I would definitely rotate, not the entire team. I think you take out key guys. I think you bring in key guys. Sorry, I should say. You bring in Loftus-Cheek. Keep him in, sorry. I think you just sit there down. Delhi, just sit down, wait till the round of 16. Mm-hmm. You just chill. I think you bring in Rashford, obviously. You bring in Danny Rose, because I think Ashley Young's been okay, but I think if you can get Danny Rose going, Rose is objectively a better player. So, like, what are you doing? You bring in Alexander-Arnold. Again, not because Trippier's been bad. Trippier's been very good, in fact. In fact, maybe you could even like keep Trippier in, but then Alexander-Arnold takes set pieces too. So, maybe you keep... But I just think you got to give... Trippier is one of England's key weapons, right? Because of his set pieces. I think you've got to keep him fresh. Keep him away from Fellaini. You know, just keep him safe. You know, and then I think you bring in Eric. I think you keep the same system. I think you bring in Eric Dier. I think you take Kane out. You rest Kane. Although that won't happen because he wants the golden boot.
So yeah, but I'll be that happy with that.
But you know, you start Rashford next to him then. But whatever. But the main thing is you keep the same system, but you bring in Eric Dier instead of Henderson, because I think Henderson is great on the ball, right? He really flings the ball forward, really fast as well. But he's not a holding midfielder. We've seen that for Liverpool this season. He's very, very 6 out of 10 at best holding midfielder, right? So against the better team, against the worst teams, that actually you don't want a holding midfielder. You want someone like Henderson in there to play passes and everything like that. Against the better team that can actually maraud through your midfield, right? Because Lingard and Dele or Lingard and Loftus-Cheek aren't going to provide you that much protection. Against the better team, maybe you play Dier there, because Dier's nowhere near the passer Henderson is, but he's still a decent passer. But what he is a very solid defensive player. Very more physically robust, faster, stronger, better across the ground, better in the tackle, better in the air. So I think you swap those two out and just see how the side plays with Dier. Not change the whole system. Just swap Dier and Henderson and just see how that affects the rest of the team, how that affects the rest of the ability to play football. I would definitely stick with Lingard and Loftus-Cheek purely because I think Fellaini's going to be in there. Fellaini's very easy to play around with pace. He's a bully. He'll probably whack Lingard something proper, but you can play around him. You know, he's slow and lumbering. Whereas, you know, you try and I just think you definitely rotate. You've got a stronger squad than Belgium Lionel. You don't change your defence though. Don't bring in Gary Cahill. Don't invite that disaster upon you. Keep your defence. Keep your goalkeeper. Just change out your wing backs. Change out bring Rashford in and bring Eric Dier into the middle of the midfield.
I would play. I agree with Mo. Don't change that sort of back four. I'd play Danny Rose. I'd keep Henderson and I'd play Delph and Loftus-Cheek either side, because that is a mobile.
Yeah, that's true.
If you keep Henderson there for flicking the balls over the top to counter attack, then you've got two mobile, strong, athletic, and also brilliant ball carriers next to him. So if we want to counter attack through Henderson's passing, he flings it over the top to Rashford and Vardy, our two fastest players. If we want to break the lines using the players, then we've got Fabian Delph, who is, I think, underrated for his dribbling ability, because we've seen him play at left back, quotation marks around that. And Loftus-Cheek, that's his best quality by far. He wins so many fouls. He's got like a 70% take on completion rate, which is really high. Moussa Dembele high. And then I'd put Alexander-Arnold right wing back, because as Mo got spot on, Alexander-Arnold will take the set pieces instead of Trippier, and that works perfectly. And also Alexander-Arnold's distribution himself, Trippier is a brilliant crosser, but I haven't seen him play sort of passes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Alexander-Arnold has played centre midfield in his younger days, and I don't think people realise how good he is at passing yet. So I think if you play that sort of five across the midfield, you've got everything you need to build a complete counter-attacking side. You've got excellent distribution to hit the channels that Vardy loves, and you've also got players that are graceful and agile enough to break past players, and also big enough to elbow Fellaini back rather than I think playing Jesse Lingard in that game is a risk, because as you said, he might be able to weave past Fellaini, but Fellaini doesn't let people get past him with the ball. The ball might go past, but he's bringing you down if you go past, and I think there's no need to risk Jesse Lingard, who we've already established is arguably the most important player.
That's a good point, actually.
So that's England versus Belgium on Thursday. We certainly look forward to seeing how that one pans out and who tops the group. Okay, next up, a bit of a wider World Cup chat of what's going on in all the group stages. Obviously, a lot of the final games this week. I was wondering if you could maybe pick, Mo, I don't know if you can pick a group which is most interestingly poised going into this final round of fixtures. We will come on to Argentina at some point, because that's a bigger topic. But away from that, which group are you looking at the most?
Oh, group F for fun. I quite like it. I think it's really interesting. I think Mexico have come in and shocked everyone in a sense of they've actually just been amazing. Like, everyone knows Mexico made the round of 16. That was the thing. But they haven't been this exciting a World Cup in a long time. They've been thrilling. I think they're probably going to top the group now. They've put themselves in a great position. I know Sweden are not the easiest side to play against, but I think Mexico will find a way, probably through a striker cutting in from the left, cutting infield onto his right foot inside a defender and stewing, which is what had both of their goals have gone so far. But Germany are back, well, kind of. You know, they awful for like half the match against Sweden. Just terrible. Boateng is horrible. But then Boateng gets sent off, which weirdly helps them. Gundogan comes on. Suddenly, Gundogan is a passing player at the base of midfield for Germany. Suddenly, Toni Kroos is like, oh, hey, it's like the old days. And Toni Kroos goes crazy second half. Defensively, still shoddy, but creating chance after chance, bringing Germany forward every time. The brass neck on that guy to shoot from where he shot. Unreal. Puts Germany in a great place now. They now have to beat Korea, who, you know, going against all stereotypes, are probably the most physical side at the tournament. Just constant fouls. So Germany will have to find a way through there, but that's a winnable game, especially now that Boateng is out. So they're probably going to bring in either Rudiger or Schüller. If they're smart, they'll bring in both of them. They'll sack off Hummels and Boateng, as we said pre-tournament. Those they've got their centre backs there, but it's the ones they're not going to play. But now they might actually play them. That's going to help them hugely. Hopefully they'll bring Gundogan in again to unleash Kroos. I don't know if they're going to bring Rudy back into the frame. I mean, he wasn't bad when he was on, so...
The broken nose might have something to say about that.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, but they're saying he's going to play with a mask, and I'm like, really? Why don't you just, like...
I think they meant if he plays, he will be wearing a face mask because he's broken his nose.
Well, you would assume Gundogan will come in, but I mean, I think that's going to be really good because I think Germany have still got flaws. But if they address those flaws in the tactical in the lineup selection that they put out, I think they could be very fun to watch. They'll still be a bit defensively suspect because they just don't have the three-man axis of Schweinsteiger, Khedira and Kroos or a variant of the axis, which I think gives them great stability. And I think taking Mesut Ozil out of the side actually has cost them a lot of control, which no one really wants to talk about. I think that was a real kind of... I understand why he did it, but it's kind of a cheap shot. I think it didn't really help them or hurt them, taking Ozil out of the side. I think... But Royce got a goal, so Royce will stay in the team. But I think it's going to be fun to watch how Germany recover from that.
Absolutely.
You know?
It was Draxler, really, that was sort of disappointing, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was very...
Royce came in for Ozil in terms of like the name that was different, but Draxler very much got given that sort of primary playmaker role. And I'm a massive fan of Julian Draxler. I think he's almost... That PSG move has not helped him develop as he was. He's obviously talented. He obviously captained that sort of Germany B team to the Confederations Cup win and was brilliant there. But I think next game they should maybe... What about Müller?
I mean...
What about him being dropped? He's obviously known for his excellent record at the World Cup, but in terms of what he's offering at the moment is
limited.
Next to nothing. And he's not even displaying that poacher's instinct. He's playing wider and he's playing in a more creative role than he ever has been. And in terms of in numbers, he's got chances created, but a chance created is a pass leading to a shot, and Germany are having lots of shots. Whether they're good or intelligent shots is sort of another matter. So I think Müller's played the most minutes now out of those three. I think it's his turn to be dropped. I think you try and play Ozil, Royce and Draxler, maybe.
Or bring Brandt in, maybe.
Brandt is the one that's been looked really good when he's come on. And Werner, I know you said about Werner playing well when he was wide.
He did, didn't he? I mean, he looks like he's not quite adapted to playing number nine in a possession-heavy side. Like, he doesn't seem to know where to stand, doesn't really have any space around you. You put him wide, suddenly the guy's, like, creating chance after chance, blitzing his opponent. I think that's what you do. I think you bring Mario Gomez into the side. I think you put Gomez up front. I think you put... Werner on the left side. I think that suddenly gives you a bit more energy and impetus. I think you bring Ozil back in because I think really Ozil and Gomez is a match made in heaven. And I think you have your Marco Reus just floating in behind. And I think, you know, Müller, he's really missing Miroslav Klose. Like, I didn't think he would because I thought he's been good, been fine since Klose stepped away. But I think it's a tournament, it's a World Cup, and he's been playing this weird sort of wide role for Bayern Munich. He's really sort of looked lost since Pep left Bayern Munich, and I think he's... because he had his best ever goal-scoring season with Pep's last season. He's looked a bit lost since then. They've not played as fine a role, and I think... I think you've got to drop Müller, I think, because he without closer to play off, what's he doing? Like, there was the whole thing, he's the Raumdeuter, the space investigator. There's no space to play off because there's no genius number nine moving into chance, creating that space for Muller to really play off. I mean, he's missed the World Cup. He could bag a hat-trick in the next game and be like, soldiers. So there's always that, but I agree with Jake. I would drop Muller.
And Ed, just wondering on the group betting and stuff, just before that, actually, the Germany-Sweden game, the late goal, was that
horrible?
Think of you when it went in.
It's generally a truism of spread betting that any late winner for a favourite is shocking. Not always, but there's the odd exception. But generally, punters throughout the game, they get with Germany at the beginning, and even when they're behind, they get with them again. The general rule is they tend to think good, you know, that the favourites will come good, and we make money when they don't, and they didn't deserve it. I thought they were so poor. But then Sweden were very naive. At the end, they could have easily
the shot
in the yeah in the court, just keep it down the corner, run
John Guidetti again in the last minute making a terrible decision. You know,
and that was it. That was probably Germany's World Cup on an up. But again, they're still in it. Fine. But I don't think our boys fancied them before the tournament, and I don't think you saw anything really in the Sweden game that would suggest that. But they do; they always build, don't they? They get better and better.
Yeah, so it's slightly dangerous. They've got Germany's size kind of grinding out results in the early stages. But I mean, in terms of the group betting, is there anything, any particular group that's sort of getting more attention than others?
So many of them, are going to come down to. I have to mention this because a very close person to me is Polish, and so they were my team.
Right.
To watch. They had their highest FIFA ranking in years, and they had a win in Berlin competitively in the last 18 months, and you thought they could really go and do something. A lot of people had them as a dark horse to follow. They were atrocious.
Very poor.
It wasn't for lack of trying. They seemed to have no pace at all. It seemed they were chasing the game the whole time. I mean, Colombia just ran rings around them.
Lewandowski looked like he was just about to tear.
Yeah, and it's not his fault. Messi's fault. You know, you can't. You know,
he's the number nine. He needs service.
Exactly.
He needs help.
But I don't know what happened to Poland. Did they freeze? But two games, no goals. On Polish media this morning, there was a thing saying, "Where do you go? Which TV channel do you go to watch the Polish goals?" And it said the History Channel, and had a picture of the Polish team from the 1930s. So they've got a good sense of humour about it. But you know, there's plenty of them in over a million in this country. So there would have been a feeling if Poland had gone deep in the tournament, we would have sort of half enjoyed that ourselves. But anyway, that was disappointing. But that group is wide open, and obviously that is going to who England will play.
Absolutely, yeah.
Anything can happen. Any combination of those, you know, Japan are dogged, aren't they?
Yeah.
Kept getting, you know, pegging them back.
Inouye is a serious player. He's an absolute dynamo. I watch out for him. I think Colombia are going to top the group now. I think they've got James back. They've got Yeromina back in defence. Just being the sort of big, tall guy that can hedge balls away, which lets Davinson Sanchez dominate as he normally does. I think I'd watch out for Colombia, man.
We've got Japan slight favourites, and then Senegal just behind in Colombia. But really, it's pick 'em for three, whoever you fancy.
It's definitely the group to watch, isn't it?
I wish Senegal were still playing a back three. I think that would really help them.
I was gonna say sort of the group H was sort of that group. I completely agree with those Poland points as well. It's like you look at their side and you look at sort of players like Zielinski for Napoli, who got used as a sub but always looked brilliant when he came on. Lewandowski had scored in all but two of his last 14 games for Poland, so they'd found service for him in all those games before, and then they've turned up in here at the World Cup and looked shocking. So that is it's just disappointing more than anything. It's really like upsetting to see them
playing in Russia.
Play that
you
bad.
Think would have been an incentive, and not just for historical reasons, but you know, it's sort of in the region for them. They're not travelling to, you know, usually. Oh, we had an awful time in South America, and the thing fell apart. It's, you know, everything was set up for them to show off, and it didn't turn up at all.
And talking to teams that are disappointed.
Yay!
Argentina. Many saw this coming, including Mo. You've mentioned it quite a lot, that you think they're a terrible side, terrible tactics, no plan.
Yeah.
That has turned out to be the case. But, I mean, funnily enough, they still win their final group game against Nigeria.
Nigeria saved them, basically. Ahmed Musa saved Argentina's World Cup. He's done more for Argentina than Messi has at the World Cup.
So who do you think is to blame, though, for the
shambles? The AFA. The AFA are by far... I mean, we like to, in this country, we like to criticise the FA, the English FA, for this and that and being just... And they are bad. They're not a great FA, but the Argentinian FA is true laughingstock. True, disastrous laughing stock. I mean, Messi is still is paying salaries for technical staff at their training centre because the AFA won't do it. At the last Copa America 2016, the reason Messi retired was because the players had to pay for their own travel and accommodation. Like, the players were made to pay, the AFA were like, we're not paying for it, we don't have any money, so you have to pay for it. And, you know, the managers chopped and changed. They had three managers in qualification. Like, three managers in a qualifying. I know the South American qualifying campaign is 3 years long, but three managers, that's just absurd, you know. And they, for example, one of their games, they flew on the same plane that Chapecoense flew on, mm-hmm. and they landed with 10 minutes of fuel left. And it's like, what do you do? I mean, no, Chapecoense shouldn't have flown that side, but you've got this squad worth, I don't know how much money it's worth. You've got the best player in the world on it. What are you doing? Mm. And it's just the AFA is the most utterly incompetent organisational board you could ever imagine. I mean, what makes me mad more than incompetence is wasting talent. Like, I'm still really mad at Brazil for 2006 World Cup because they had this amazing team with so much talent and ability, and they flushed it down the toilet by bringing back Ronaldo, Cafu, and Carlos. And so the same thing with Argentina. You've got Aguero, great forward, Di Maria. Now, okay, Higuain's a bit of a disaster, but you've got Messi, for crying out loud. You've got how can you not build a winning team around these guys? Mm. These are some of the best players in the world. Messi's the best player probably of all time, certainly one of the top four. And how do you not build a team around him? And it's just so frustrating. And they constantly get the wrong managers in to do the job. And then when they finally bring the right guy in, Sampaoli, they give him such a short leash and keep him on such a... like. I'll give you an example, right? Before the tournament, they played Haiti in a friendly, right? And they played 4-3-3, and they had, just like Southgate, actually, just like England, they had Lanzini and Lo Celso in midfield. These are attacking midfielder wingers, right? They were central midfielders in that game. And it was really interesting to watch. I mean, only Haiti. Like, it was only Panama. But you watch it, and they pushed up centrally. Lanzini would go wide when Messi would come in off the flank. And it worked. It was really dynamic and interesting. Then Lanzini got a really unfortunate injury. And Sampaoli just scrapped the whole thing. First game of the tournament, it's 4-2-3-1 with two holding midfielders against Iceland. Like, what the hell is going on? So he has to take some of the blame. But the majority of the blame has to go with the AFA. They're absolutely, utterly incompetent. And the fact that they've had Lionel Messi, and he's dragged them to three finals in three consecutive years, four finals if you count 2011 Copa America. And it's beyond comprehension. It really is.
I think, despite Tim Sherwood wanting to blame it on the tattoos...
Is that what
he said? Oh yeah, so he couldn't believe Sampaoli had sleeve tattoos and thought that was the cause of all their trouble. I think he does deserve, in terms of the football at this World Cup, Mo said it there, like, you play one formation and look quite functional and quite fluid, and playing Lucas Bielsa and Javier Mascherano
against Iceland.
Mascherano playing, I can't remember who it was, but it made a good point. Mascherano's obviously been a brilliant player for a long time and is very intelligent, knows exactly how to play his role, but there's a reason Barcelona stopped playing him, and there's a reason that he's moved on. He's obviously Absolutely. He's not as good as he was, and the squad is very sort of top heavy. Argentina's been like that for ages, and it's top heavy almost. It doesn't mean the midfielders are bad, it's just the attacking talent is so good that the midfielders look worse in comparison. And yeah, Mo obviously has said a lot about the whole setup of Argentina and football in that country, but at this tournament they've looked poor, and the direction that they've been given in those two games, they've played two different formations, they've played two different styles of play. Messi in the first game had 11 shots, everything was going through him. In the second, it took 64 minutes to have one shot, and that's all he managed the whole game. So there were two completely different games, both looked awful, and I think as much as the preparation may have been bad, the decisions within those, if you take those games in isolation as well, there's not really any positives.
Yeah, I think the Argentina were playing rugby on Saturday night as well against Scotland at home, and they got absolutely stuffed and the team fell apart. And there's a lot of people have been saying the Argentinian rugby union are underfunded and stuff. I think the problem for both codes is that the talent gets farmed to Europe almost straight away. Mm. I've traded some Argentinian first division games in the office, and they're dreadful. The standard's terrible. Anyone who shows any talent at all is shipped off to Spain. Same with the rugby players. So you have, and of course, they're sent back for camps and stuff, but it's a long way to travel. Mm. It's asking a lot in the modern age where money talks to keep players, which obviously you can't, because why would they stay there? And then I suppose, unless you have good organisation that can just about manage that, this is what happens. You get one or two quality players, you know, struggling, paying for the plane journeys and paying for the coaches and so on. And but let's not pretend that we don't enjoy watching this.
No, it's
from an England point of view, to see Germany struggle, to see Argentina struggle, to see Brazil struggle, it gets us a little bit excited. Mm. Plus, it's always good to see the people that have beaten us in the past.
Yeah, it's all going through shambles that we've kind of maybe felt.
I mean, we've got lots of money. We can't ever blame that on the reason why we're no use. But
I mean, that's exactly it. The Argentinian league is so. The clubs make their money on selling players, right? There's no sort of internal sort of structure or revenue where they actually just subsist on their own like basis. So it's all about selling players, and that's really conditioned the way that players are produced, because any half decent player is shoved into attack. No one wants Argentine midfielders, right? And for some reason, no one thinks of that. The players that fetch the big prices are, oh, he's a winger, oh, he's an attacker, oh, he's a midfielder. That's why Argentina have like 11 billion players that you can classify as an attacking midfielder or winger. But you can't name one really good creative midfielder, central midfielder, after Ever Banega. Like, you can't name one that's even close to him. And it's like, because they just don't produce that play anymore. When was the last time they had a fullback worthy of Javier Zanetti? Tagliafico might be the only one, and he's not that great. He's just good. Where's their goalkeepers? Romero's been their goalkeeper. I mean, Romero was a soldier for them, and I think his injury has actually been a big miss, but Romero was their goalkeeper. The guy couldn't start a game for Sampdoria or Monaco or Man United. And it's like, what are you doing? Centre-backs, they've got a few massive bruisers, but where's the new Ezequiel Garay? Where's the new Fazio? You know, Mamana got shipped off to where was it? Lyon, very early in his career, before he was ready for it. You know, players are sold too early. There's not any sort of structural plan in the country for the players to develop. And so you just don't get this a big talent dearth. Like, I worry for what happens to Argentina once Messi retires, honestly, because there's Dybala, and Dybala's great, but that's what else is there? Young age, Lautaro Martinez. Okay, fine. That's an attacking midfielder and a striker. Who's coming through central midfield? Pavon. Oh, he's a winger. Well, again, it's the same. They're going to have the same problems with a whole new generation of players, and it's really, really depressing. And then added to that, yes, as Jake said, Sampaoli needs to cop a huge amount of the blame, because he picked a really weird squad, didn't take certain players that could have helped him, took Mascherano. Okay, fine, took Mascherano, started Mascherano. You know, didn't take Garay. Doesn't play Banega, even though he's his only creative central midfielder. So it's 99%, well, not 99, it's like 90% the AFA. They are just the worst. But 10% São Paulo, I think.
Take some blame, yeah.
There are clearly deep-rooted problems that have led to this situation, but then now they've got here and qualified. Messi qualified them with a hat-trick. They finally had that redemption.
Yeah.
Right, now probably you're in the World Cup. Yeah. Take a chance to build, look at what's got wrong, make sure you approach it in the right way. They have not done that at all.
And they could have done it. That's the mad thing. I mean, they had this whole thing where the FA, the president of the FA, scheduled a friendly in Israel, where none of the players wanted to play in Israel, none of the coaches wanted to play in Israel, and it was like, no. And so then they cancelled it, and then it was a big contrary. But then they only played one warm-up game before the World Cup, and it was against Haiti. So it's like, how much are you actually practicing? I mean, Sampaoli made the whole thing about, oh, it's more important for me to coach the players, and I would understand that. But then he came out with opposite game plans. He played the way he should have played against Croatia, against Iceland, but the way he should have played against Iceland, against Croatia. It's like, what are you doing? Are you drunk?
The thing is, having said all that, they can still qualify.
Yeah.
So, Ed, I don't know what the trading is on that game, Argentina and Algeria.
They're quite lowly on our 100 index, 100 for winning, obviously, 75 all the way down. We've got them at 15-18, which positions them somewhere between 10 points for the last 16 and 25 for the quarterfinals. So if you think they're going to get through, just you buy the 18, and that will shoot right up once they get through. Because again, say what you want about them, but if they get to the knockout stages, it's still Argentina. They might come good. Something might happen. Sides get a bit wary. So I think last night, a few punters were having little buys of Argentina on their index.
I think if you're going to bet on Argentina, now would be the time to do it. Because they've been rubbish. They've not looked like they've been good, but they could turn it on. They've got Messi, they've got Aguero, they've got Di Maria, who occasionally is brilliant. Pavon is amazing. If he starts the right team against Nigeria, they could turn it on. If they unleash Messi, that's too much quality, probably, for Nigeria to be able to handle. Although Ahmed Musa against the Argentine defence should be hilarious. But if they drop Willy Caballero, which they're probably going to do, bring in Franco Armani, that's a huge step up. He's been great for River Plate. You know, if they pick the right team, whoever picks the right team, there's rumours Sampaoli isn't even going to pick the team against Nigeria, but whoever picks the team, they pick the right team against Nigeria and they win, that puts them in the last 16.
Nigeria notoriously good against Argentina.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, at the last World Cup, it was 4-2. Like, Messi basically pulled off a miracle to pull them past it. And in the recent friendly, Argentina were doing well. I think they're winning 2-1 or 2-0, and then they made a bunch of subs. Messi wasn't playing in the game. They made a bunch of subs, and Argentina, like, and Nigeria just destroyed them. So it's going to be a fun game, I think. That might be the game to watch, actually.
Game of the week, I think, in terms of everything. Bookings, goals, the lot.
It could be everything, yes. Yeah. Something could be up and down during the game. It could be going one way than
the
other.
But, of course, one final thing is, if they do get out of the groups by some miracle, they have to play France.
So you're looking forward to seeing that one, potentially?
That's going to be a bit of a shooing, isn't it?
I don't know.
I suppose if there's any manager who rivals Sampaoli's ability to get in his own way, it is Didier Deschamps. So, I mean, again, you look at the France, you have to think there's too much quality in the France team for that.
You would think so, and that's certainly lots to look forward to in the group stages as they conclude this week. Okay, next up, we're going to have a quick discussion about the Golden Boot race. It's, you know, changed quite a lot as games go on. Harry Kane now leads the way with 5. You've got Ronaldo with 4, Lukaku with 4. Jake, who do you think will get it, and your thoughts on the race so far?
The race is really interesting because Lukaku and Kane have had as many shots on target as they've scored goals. So every time they've hit the target, they've scored so far. So that doesn't sound sustainable in the first place. And obviously Kane's 2 were penalties and 1 was an incredible back heel, I think.
But premeditated.
Yeah, exactly. Great pass by Loftus-Cheek, I think. But in all seriousness, so Ronaldo's the one still pumping out most shots. He's also had 4 shots on target, 4 goals, but he's had 10 shots. So in terms of sort of how it would even out, obviously it depends on how far people go. But Harry Kane's only 1 away from the magic number 6, which has won the last Golden Boot. So if he gets there, you'd make him favourite. And with England playing so well and looking fluid and him understanding his role, he probably is the favourite. And the fact he's leading the race, although I think Portugal will get the result to go through against Iran, which again is a sort of a game that we haven't spoken about, but should be really interesting given the second half of that Iran-Spain game.
Yeah.
But Kane's favourite, but I think the amount of shots Ronaldo takes and the fact that Portugal are completely geared towards him and completely happy to do it, I think we could see another Ronaldo hat-trick come in soon. So even if they get knocked out early, he could pip it.
Definitely be in the running. I think, so that's 7 of the last 10 Golden Boot winners have finished with 6. And obviously, you maybe expect that to be surpassed on this occasion. Ed, is Kane your pick, and is it who the traders are going for?
Well, he is jolly by quite some margin. We do 100 for winning, 75, 50, all the way down to 5 points for 8th place. We've got Kane 76, 81 on our 100 index. Next in's Ronaldo, 57, 62. So, you know, it's not quite all over, but we absolutely put Kane up there. The one I'd tip up now, if I'm not allowed to tip, but, you know, certainly punters have been picking up, is Diego Costa. He's got 3 goals. Spain, I think, have alluded to, might have a decent run in the tournament, draw opening up, and he's 34-38. So I think a lot of people are buying Costa. He's someone to watch. He can obviously score at will. Lukaku, there's injury doubts about him. He's got 4, whatever. Neymar, 1 goal.
Still can't rule him out, can you?
Well, he's 10-13, so if you think he's going to come good. And
he's got one, though, hasn't he?
He's got one. I don't think didn't look like there's that many goals in the Brazil side. But no, I think Kane, it's his to lose, really. Mm. You know, if he gets 1 or 2 more in this tournament. You know, Lineker won it going out in the quarterfinals, didn't he, in 86. I think if Kane gets 1 or 2 more, he's probably a guaranteed tie anyway. But no, Costa would be the one if you haven't had a punt at this point, Costa's the one.
To do it. Mo, do you agree with that? Who are you going for?
You look at the top goal scorers, right? I mean, Kane is top, right? He's got 5 goals, hasn't really played well at all yet, which is kind of scary when you think about it, right? Like 2 tap-ins off ahead, off corners, 2 penalties. I mean, great penalties, but 2 penalties, and then an absolute, like Jake says, genius back heel. You know? So he's not really played well. Cristiano looks at lights out right now, but look who he's got next. He's got Iran next. Iran are very good defensively. They've conceded, you know, not really 2 goals, both of them very unlucky. Not 2 goals, 1 goal. What am I talking about? 1 goal, and it was a fluke, basically. So they're incredible defensively. And if let's say Portugal get past Iran, right, because they might do, they've got to play Uruguay in the next round. I would not bet on Cristiano. I just think they've been great. They'll get towards him, but I think they're now going to run headlong into 2 very, very good defences. And Carlos Queiroz in particular would know everything about Cristiano Ronaldo. So if anyone else had to push his buttons and stop him, it's that guy. Lukaku is probably got an injury doubt. Honestly, this sounds really, really dramatic, but I think that could be if he was hobbling and he came off injured. I think that's a problem. I think if he's going to lose even a little bit of his mobility and his you look at how smartly he scored his goals, right? It's all been all about movement and really, really intelligent movement. If he can't move that freely, that's a problem for him. And and Batshuayi is so good, they'll just bring him in or push De Bruyne forward or whatever. Cheryshev, again, he faces Uruguay.
You've got to factor in
and then they play Spain next if they get through, or you know, or they play Portugal. So either way, they're not getting a good an easy game. And then, so yeah, obviously I agree. I think Costa's a good shout. I think keep an eye on him. Spain are going to go far. I think they've looked the class of the tournament so far. He's looking happy in rhythm. He scores even when he's barely trying to, like against Iran. And then also one person to keep an eye on is John Stones.
Exactly, after his double.
John Stones, 2 goals. Could have scored in the first game as well. More shots on goal than misplaced passes. Johnny Stones, there's your man.
Outside bet for that one.
That tip Jake Entwistle on the stat.
Yes, absolutely. Jake came through with the stats after that game, I tell you.
And just finally on the top scorer, Ed, I just wondered if there must be people like Messi and Griezmann who are amongst the favourites but haven't scored yet. How much have they dropped? And is it?
No, they plummeted. I mean, I'm just looking at the top seven.
Yeah.
Messi, if you want to buy him, I think you can pay 6 on the 100 index. Yeah. So low risk, but obviously it's unlikely. Hazard's another one I'd put. He's got 2.
Yeah.
7-9.
He takes the penalty.
You pay 9. You can obviously make, if he wins it, you win 91 times your stake. Downside of 9, which is a reasonable wager, and if Lukaku is out, you presume that Hazard is going to take on slightly more of the attack. Also, Costa, I said, but I think Hazard with the other one to look at. He's such a quality player.
Absolutely.
Lovely balance. That goal he scored when he just tapped it, stayed on his feet. He's someone that, you know, if Belgium go deep into the tournament, he could easily get a hat trick somewhere and be banging the reckoning.
Yeah, I mean, just to quickly go on Costa, we were talking about the path to the finals, right? And obviously the path to the final is 7 games. Great phrase. You should trademark that, by the way. You look at Spain's, right? Spain was scheduled to, they're going to have to face Mohamed Salah's Egypt. They were going to have to face Argentina in the quarterfinals. Lionel Messi's Argentina. They're going to have to face Germany in the semifinals. They had a really tough group. Egypt have flopped, so they're going to face Russia probably now in the round of 16. Germany have flopped, so Argentina flopped, so they might end up facing Croatia. Now that's a bit of a wash because Croatia is still a very good side, but Croatia are a good side in the way that Spain can beat them. It's a midfield. Croatia have the second best midfield in this tournament. Who has the best? Spain. So, and then in semi-finals, who knows what it could be? It should have been Germany. Germany aren't in that half of the draw anymore. It could be Mexico. Like, so Spain have now, as long as they keep their heads, it's set up for them to go, I would say, at least to the semis, maybe even to the final. Because all the elite teams from their side of the draw have sort of fallen off. So they've got a very, that's why I think Costa's a very good shout.
I'd say it's nice to see sort of it changing game by game, the top scorer markets, and we'll sure that'll continue sort of as the group stages finished and then into the knockout stages. Okay, we're going to finish up with some listeners' questions. Thank you as always for sending them in. I've got one for you, Jake, first. This is from Dan Summerfield. Will England-Belgium be the first match to be played in the World Cup that both teams want to lose? Obviously we've discussed this previously in the pod, but you can see where he's coming from. But do you think that's the case?
Yeah, so as I said, my standpoint on it is that it could be. No one wants to lose, and I think losing at this stage is bad for going ahead in the tournament in terms of momentum and sort of those sort of intangibles that you need to maintain. But who's to say that a high foul count and a 2-2 draw that sees England finish second is not a good thing? That's what I mean. It could. Belgium Belgium and England are playing a good side for the first time in the tournament, and one, Belgium especially didn't even play that many good sides in friendlies, so they'll relish the test, and it will be a good indicator of how far they can go in the tournament. And as I said, England can test out this new strategy that is built to play against the teams that are objectively more talented player for player than England. So yeah, I don't think either team would want to lose, but England are top at the moment based on one fewer yellow card. So if we put Fabian Delphine to hack a few people down and players that aren't going to play, Jamie Vardy can maybe do a bit of descent up front.
I suppose it's very different losing the game and not finishing top of the group, isn't it? Because there's two very different effects. So he gets sure and still finishes.
Exactly. And maybe we just let Belgium. So maybe we pick up one yellow card, we draw, and then we get to see the first live draw of lots to decide who goes first and second in the group. And that would be a win-win situation because we could say, oh, it was a hard-fought draw. We played very well against a good team. Unfortunately, we picked up the booking. And if we finish second from that, then no one can say a bad word because it was literally luck of the draw.
Absolutely. And the next question is from... You like that, didn't you, Mo?
I love that. That's great. I hope it happens.
And then this is from Sir Harvey Cruz.
Yeah.
It's out of all the World Cup favourites, who has been the least convincing so far and what can they do to rectify it?
Argentina, right? Like, no, Germany. Argentina were never favourites. Germany have been the least convincing. What can they do to rectify it? I think we discussed it. They need to bring in Mario Gomez, bring back Mesut Ozil, #FreeMesut. I would even go so far as to say maybe they should tinker with pushing Kroos into number 10 again, like they did when they won the World Cup, bringing Gundogan, bringing Rudy at the base of midfield. I mean, Rudy, anyone really, any healthy body at the base of midfield. Hell, put De Stegen there, man. The guy can play. You know, two guys at the base of midfield, one of them being Gundogan, play Kroos ahead of them. That's going to unleash him. Also at the back, get rid of Hummels, get rid of Boateng. They are rubbish. I mean, Hummels is just kind of out of form, but Boateng is done. Bring in Rudiger, who's phenomenal. Bring in Sula, who is just a colossus. And just do that. I mean, before the last game against Sweden, I was also saying that to bring De Stegen in, but Neuer looked pretty boss against Sweden. So, you know, I mean, he got lobbed when he shouldn't have done, but, you know, other than that, he was pretty boss. So, you know, he's the captain, lead him in. But, yeah, just replace the central defenders, replace the central midfielders, unleash Toni Kroos as an attacking player. Stop asking him to be Xavi. He's not Xavi. He's either Andrea Pirlo at the base of midfield or he's an attacking midfielder. Don't let him be anything else. Don't ask him to be anything else. He can't be that. Maximise those things. I think you can do that easily. And if Argentina are counted as a favourite, then pray.
I think France are getting away with not being mentioned.
I was about to say that.
It's because they've just been bland. They've then been bad. Like,
yeah, Germany, that is bad though. How can you have a team stacked with like Griezmann, true. Mbappe, Dembele, Fekir, Tovan, Thomas Lamar,
But then isn't that an option? Like, is there an option to sack Deschamps and appoint Zidane or appoint Arsene Wenger?
You obviously can't argue with the fact that they've won two games, but in terms of France and this sort of... And people talk about Belgium having a golden generation and an incredible squad. France have got the best squad at the World Cup. They can play two completely different 11s in a 4-3-3. And on paper, you would expect both of them to go deep in the competition.
But the thing is, though, with France, it's not... because it's. I think because the entire squad will still be there in 4 years' time.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's why it's not a golden generation.
So that's what I'm saying. It's not. People are looking at Belgium's squad being like, wow, that's incredible. They need to do stuff. I'm not saying it is France's golden generation.
Yeah. It is, but it's just I think their shot will be Qatar. I think
there's no way that they should be happy with how they're performing.
If you expect more from France,
I think if they somehow manage to go far and obviously prove me completely wrong, then fair enough. I think Giroud has been their best player. He's so important when he plays because of the style Deschamps plays. But I can imagine that they're going to fall short soon because they haven't looked convincing. They've looked worrying at the back and they're not getting the best out of their incredibly talented players. So yeah, I don't think Deschamps, in the same way that Sampaoli might not be Argentina manager at the end of this, unless Deschamps, as I said, proves me wrong and the talent carries him through, I don't think he's making a great claim to stay as a...
For me, and I was saying this before the tournament, Arsene Wenger and Zinedine Zidane came on the job market before the tournament. They should have sacked Deschamps before the tournament started and appointed one of them. I mean, I'm not joking. But as Jake said, their squad is outrageous. I mean, and the fact that he plays, that has them playing the way they do, and it's not even the system, because honestly, 4-2-3-1 with those players actually kind of works, right? It's not even the system. Giroud is, you know, everyone's always hot on Giroud, but Giroud is, like Jake says, a good choice for that role. You know, they just got to get rid of him. He just makes everything so negative. Why is Pavard right back? Pavard's a centre-back. He's a young centre-back. Play Sidibe, or take an actual right back if you don't play Sidibe. Unleash Benjamin Mendy, you know...
This is the only thing that I will say in defence, is perhaps that maybe he's seen the group stages, right, we've got Denmark, Australia, Peru, none of those are particularly dangerous. If I can get away with just winning, because Sidibe and Mendy both had injuries before the World Cup, and they played in some of the friendlies, but they've been dropped for both group games. Mm. Whether Pavard and Hernandez have been brilliant in training, I don't know, but you can sense that France have said, right, let's just get through that group, get everyone fit, and then people will see the real France that our team sheet says it should be in the next round.
Got to play Dembele, man. Got to play Dembele, Mbappe and Griezmann behind Giroud, just for maximum just magnificence.
So, certainly a good question. That one got us talking with France and Germany to improve. And Ed, just giving you the final word in terms of what you expecting from the tournament and what you've made of it so far, yeah, and what Sporting Index is offering.
Well, I'd agree with a lot of what's just been said. I think, just coming back to the England-Belgium game, I think a draw is probably the way to go, possibly with some late booking shenanigans. maybe putting Fellaini on late to elbow someone to... it just reminds me of going back to 82, when the whole reason why they put the last games together was the game that was concocted between Germany and Austria. And anyone who hasn't seen that, just go on YouTube and there's highlights on it. Just see what happens when neither side wants to particularly lose or do anything.
Happy with the draw.
It's slightly different circumstances, but it's great fun to watch that as a reminder to anyone. And I think it's been a wonderful tournament so far. It really has. I think it's been... We were 2-0 up at half-time against the punters. I think it's 2-2 now. Punters have come back. The England game killed.
All to play for.
Yeah, Germany, all to play for. And I think this is going to be a great week of games. And Argentina, Nigeria will be the one I'll be most excited about watching.
Absolutely.
And last little thing as well, 32 games halfway through, not a single 0-0.
I know, that's pretty impressive, isn't it?
That's the one stat as well that is sort of... The last time it happened was a whole tournament and it was only 26 games. So this World Cup, although some of the 1-0s have not been great... You're always seeing a goal, which is all you ever ask for, as sort of a neutral, isn't it?
And there haven't been any bad games where you've thought, oh, this is just completely painful to watch. Yeah.
Iran-Morocco was pretty bad.
I think Morocco, again, they've been sort of the unlucky side in the sense that it's frustrating, but it's not been boring to watch.
No.
And I think that's just about all we've got time for this week. So,
keep going.
we could talk for hours as always.
Yeah.
Thanks to Mo for coming again.
My pleasure. Please, World Cup, stick around for longer.
Thanks to Jake.
Yeah. My pleasure as always. Thanks.
And thanks to Ed from Sporting Index. So good to have you in again.
Thanks for having me back.
We'll see you next time.
Hey friend, I know how this feels, waking up exhausted after multiple trips to the bathroom and feeling embarrassed by sudden leaks. I used to be constantly on edge, searching for a restroom whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Woman. I was skeptical at first, but 2 months in, everything changed. I experienced improved bladder control. No more heart-stopping moments when I laugh or sneeze. Less urge to go. Deeper and more restful sleep. I finally felt like myself again, confident and in control. Better Woman is natural, effective, clinically tested, and trusted by women for over 25 years. Ready to take back your control? Head over to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Uses directed, individual results may vary.